$ on expensive military projects, with plans to spend hundreds of billions more to project Britain's military might internationally. But while it's loosened the purse strings of military spending, the British government has tightened them on the country's underfunded public health system and on foreign aid, where it used to lead the way. The $5.5 billion cut will mean less relief for war-torn Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UN Secretary General has called the move a death sentence. The cuts also affect aid to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and other life-saving projects in countries such as Syria, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan. Hundreds of charities, academics, and business leaders have signed a letter warning the government the cuts cast a shadow over the nation's role at the G7 and risk undermining its credibility on the world stage.
The amount of weapons that we are selling to be dropped on the head of the Yemenis on one side, and on the other side denying them any sort of support or cutting down those support, it really is outrageous, unacceptable.
The British government says its decision to slash foreign aid was a response to the economic shock brought on by the pandemic, meaning perhaps that once the health crisis blows over, foreign aid will go back to previous levels. Despite the pandemic, government aid designed to promote the economic development and welfare of developing countries rose to an all-time high last year, with the largest contributions coming from the U.S., followed by Germany. Britain took third place.
There is a fraction within the sort of extreme right who always wanted to cut our contribution to these countries, and they never believed in helping, giving a helping hand. And I think this is an excuse. Right now, it's an excuse to actually give in to those section of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a rebellion at home from MPs, including his predecessor Theresa May, pushing the government to reconsider. Theirs and a growing number of other voices are urging Britain to be the world leader it claims to be. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change. But as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Homa Lizgi, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdusalam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing up the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine, since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us, since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemen Nasrallah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S., which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Nasrallah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem or Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Si tratta di avere una posizione equilibrata.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally, as on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the Rai national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of the life. Keys of life.
I told Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We said that we are in part two, and part two is how we, or our relationship with other people, and chapter one of part two was our relationship with our kin. Now we're entering into chapter two of part two, and that is our relationship with fellow Muslims. And fellow Muslims are divided here. Ayatollah Jawadi divides this discussion, this chapter, into three parts. The first is our ta'amul, how do we deal with fellow mu'mineen, fellow believers, the faithful, the practicing, if we could say, practicing Muslims. And number two, how do we deal with sinning Muslims? And number three, how do we deal with those who appear to be Muslims, hypocrites, for example, and whatnot. We're going to discuss the other two, but in today's discussion, what are the rights of your fellow Muslim religious practicing believers? The hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "Ahabbu ikhwani, the best of my fellow brethren, man ahda ilayya uyubi, ahabbu ikhwani ilay, man ahda ilayya uyubi, the best of my brothers is one who gifts, man ahda hadiyya, it's a hadiyya, man ahda, who gifts to me my faults in the form of a packaging of a gift." Saying it in a nice way, in a kind way, with love, with respect, with compassion, with elevating that person's status, reminding them of, you know, there might be a little bit of an issue here, a little bit of a difficulty there. That's what brothers are for. That's what sisters are for. We want to keep our friends. We want to keep our brothers. We want to keep our sisters. We want to empower the fellow believers. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Azdiqa'uka, azdiqa'uka thalatha." Your brothers or your friends are three, and your enemies are three. Your friends are your friends, and your friends' friends, and your friends' friends' friends, and your enemy's enemy. And your enemies are your enemy, the enemy of your friend, and the friend of your enemy. From Nahj al-Balagha, Hikmah number 295. The point here is that, of course, you need to make sure that you are someone who has a stance, has a mawqif. You always remember that you have your brethren. You need to stand with them, not in batil, but always in haqq. Remembering that we always need to cover and conceal the faults of our fellow brothers and sisters, those who are practicing Muslims.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فلان نماز قصاب داره فلان روزه اون
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فلان درخت کاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم داره این دقل ثواب داره
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون این هم همون امام گفته دیگه
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, Ya ma'ashar, O people, O ummah, man aslama bilisanihi, someone who is a Muslim by their lisan, wa lam yukhlis al-iman ila qalbihi, and doesn't have that sincerity of faith in their hearts. لا تذم المسلمون المسلمين ولا تتبعوا أوراتهم Don't criticize fellow Muslims and don't follow their faults. Conceal their faults. You know, try to keep that level of brotherhood from one another. You know, try to keep their dignity. Try to remember that we're always going to make mistakes, but it is for us to cover up and for us to, you know, always remember to have benefit of the doubt. To forgive also if someone does make a mistake. We forgive them and we forget what it is that they have made as mistakes. Allahumma man rafaqa min ummati farfiq bihi wa man shaqqa alayhim fashuqqa alayh. You know, having that level of mercy, having that level of compassion, always remembering that you're going to make a mistake once, as we always need to keep that in our minds and always remember that we need to do dua for our fellow Muslims, for our fellow believers. Also, visiting one another is a very, very recommended thing that is always important. And that's one of the huquq of our religion, Islam. And, You know, even shaking of hands, you know, the hadith says, تَصَافَحُوا تَتَسَاقَطْ ذُنُوبُكُمْ. Shake each other's hands and sins will fall apart. Here the hadith says, إِذَا تَلَاقَيْتُمْ فَتَلَاقَوْا بِالْتَسْلِيمِ. When you meet one another, meet with your salam. Greet one another. وَإِذَا تَفَرَّقْتُمْ فَتَفَرَّقُوا بِالْإِسْتِغْفَارِ. And if you separate from each other, separate with forgiving one another as well, and asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive the sins of each other's person. We need to remember that, you know, you also need to be emotionally there for people. Number one, materially there. Number two, spiritually there. Morally there. Number three, moral support. Number three is emotional support. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala ashrafi khalqillahi Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart. There will always be there, be there.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
یکی از بیماری هایی که امام سجاد ازش به خدا پناه میبره تکلفه.
امام سجاد علیه السلام in his supplication towards Allah asks him for safety against تکلف. In his dua, امام سجاد says, O Allah, I take refuge in you from تکلف. Now, what is the meaning of تکلف? In one sense, this term means making oneself suffer for unnecessary formalities. Takalluf also means pretension or affectation.
به عبارت دیگر اگه یه بی سواد بخواد خودشو با سواد جلوه بده اینو میگن تکلف.
In better words, if an illiterate person wants to pretend as a literate one or a poor acts as if he is a rich person, this act of him or her is called تکلف. Sometimes some people borrow money to act as a rich one. There are also some who want to behave like others when in a meeting or party. These people want to imitate others and be the same as others. Thus, such people suffer from unnecessary formalities and needs. In today's world, many people are afflicted with takalluf in various forms. The people today want to display themselves as what they are not. They want to pretend as being something else. It is a major problem in today's world, and people have to remove it from their lifestyles. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
Some Asian Americans in the U.S. are stuck in situations where every choice is bad and where authority figures have exacerbated problems rather than aiding solutions, says Scott Kershage, a writer, in an article published under the heading Spree of Anti-Asian Violence in U.S. Has Long Roots. Stay tuned for more. In response to thousands of reported bias incidents, the call and budding movement to Stop Asian Hate has fostered an unprecedented wave of Asian American solidarity that has quickly spread nationwide following the Atlanta area shootings. This has been heavily driven by a collective sense of fear and outrage that anyone in the community might be the next target. Videos of Asian elders being attacked and, in extreme cases, killed by much younger men have gone viral, but so has the video of American-born Koreans. This seemingly random quality of anti-Asian violence draws Asian Americans from diverse backgrounds together through a process that scholar Yen Sprito has termed reactive solidarity. One of the most oft-cited accounts of anti-Asian violence occurred near Detroit in 1982. Vincent Chin, a Chinese-American man, died after being beaten on the head with a baseball bat by a white man, who witnesses said complained that Japanese competition was causing layoffs of American auto workers. Tragically, Chin's murder is only one of many examples of Asian Americans being targeted by assailants who can't tell Americans apart. In 1989, another Chinese-American, Jim Ming Hai Lu, died after an attack by two white brothers who were heard railing about the Vietnam War. In 1996, Tien Minh Lai, a Vietnamese-American, was stabbed to death by a neo-Nazi. 3 years later, Joseph Ilito, a Filipino-American postal worker, was shot and killed while delivering on his USPS postal route by a white supremacist who wanted him dead for being a Latino or Asian federal government employee. To situate discussions of anti-Asian violence in proper historical and structural context, we need to recover the overlooked histories that are generally known outside of their immediate time and place, only within small niches of Asian American scholars and activists. In 1992, a group of white men boastfully reported of a crusade to beat up people in Southwest Philadelphia. They were targeting a Southeast Asian refugee community that had resettled into a city structured by redlining, anti-blackness, biased policing, capital flight, and segregation by race and class. One of the white men described to a Philadelphia magazine reporter in October 1992 how he and 14 others dragged Asian Americans at will off of local streetcars. Dissecting the construction of this feud necessitates tracing back how white and Asian populations would up in the overlapping spaces of neighborhood. The roots of white supremacist violence and vigilantism run deep in the city of brotherly love. As the co-authors of the book Philadelphia, Neighborhoods, Division, and Conflict in a Post-Industrial City wrote, fraternal bonds of whiteness constructed ghettos of opportunity surrounding bustling factories during the industrial era from the mid-19th to mid-20th centuries. By 1970s, however, automation and outsourcing caused multiple factories in the city's southwest to close, move, or downsize. As black areas of settlement expanded outward from the inner city, jobs and many white residents fled to the suburbs. Feeling left behind, some Philadelphia whites accustomed to segregation as the natural order grew resentful and violent. In 1979, two white men looking for N-word to shoot climbed onto a factory roof and killed 13-year-old Tracy Chambers, the first African-American who passed by. Some violent exchanges ensued between white and black youths. In 1985, a mob of 400 whites demanded that a black family vacate their home on a previously all-white block. The following month, arsonists burned it to the ground. Refugees displaced by the Vietnam War, which also spread to Cambodia and Laos, were initially resettled in more impoverished, majority black sections of the city. As researchers Ellen Sumkawa documented, slumlords had contracted with resettlement agencies to fill their vacant and deteriorating complexes with refugees given little to no choice in the matter. In the 1980s, the neighborhood's core remained nearly all white, but the unwritten rule prohibiting sales to black buyers accelerated the fall of housing prices. Seeing a new escape hatch, dozens of white families began selling unlisted homes to Southeast Asian refugees for $15,000 to $20,000, circumventing fair housing policies. Shocked by the rapid turnover, some whites began harassing and intimidating their new neighbors. When reporters surveyed white men and boys in the area in the early 1990s, they found many who proudly declared they were skinheads, new Nazis, and members of white power gangs. Asian Americans are stuck in situations where every choice is bad and where authority figures have exacerbated problems rather than aiding solutions. Sometimes the best that community organizers can do is shine a light on the worst abuses and mitigate the worst harm. Still, what these grassroots organizers strive to do is uplift marginalized voices and concerns in order to get at the root causes of oppression. Their commitment to confronting anti-Asian racism and violence have thus led them to struggle against gentrification and police brutality and for the rights of immigrants, youth, workers, and small business owners. In so doing, they have fostered new bases for multi-racial coalitions and alliances.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's segment of Back to Reality, brought to you by RRB English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have the pleasure of hosting two wonderful guests. I'll leave the introduction to themselves.
I'm Mudaffar Haider, at your service today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for joining us.
And I'm Hasnain Ali. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum wa rahmatullah. The role of a father.
In the family?
In the family, obviously. And what happens when that role fades out? When it's not executed properly. Either there isn't a father figure at all to carry out that role in a family, or there is a father figure, but he's doing a horrendous job at it. And I think the latter happens more often. Like, I would say 80% of families I've seen in my glorious life upon God's green earth suffered to an extent from dysfunctional fathers. And that's a fact. The world is a broken place because fathers are doing a horrible job at being fathers. Are you a father, Brother Mudaffar?
I'm a father, yeah.
I'm trying to be.
Brother Hassanain, you're not a dad, are you?
No, I'm not even a husband.
Okay, yeah. Wonderful. How long have you been a dad?
I've been a dad for 3 years.
Since you were 20?
25.
How have you found the experience?
It's really cool. I love it. You know, I can't remember. I was not a father before, you know, and now I'm a father. It still hasn't hit me, but I'm really happy about it. Alhamdulillah.
Yeah, but it's not specifically about father being the, leader of the family, right? Like, we're just talking the man, the husband. Or is it just father?
We're talking about the man in general, but, like, if your husband is doing a horrible job at being a husband, you just divorce him and leave. But you can't divorce your father and leave. You just have to stay in his house and endure his failed attempt at being a father and then turn into a dysfunctional adult and ruin the society. That's what I'm talking about. And it's really important that we address this because fight the patriarchy. No, that's not the reason. I don't even believe in the patriarchy. But الرجال قوامون على النساء.
Excellent. The verse is absolutely true. It's one of the verses of the Quran, and it's a reality.
Mm.
Men are the maintainers, the sustainers of women.
Yeah.
And they are. If you just practically look at it, they are the ones who are the natural breadwinners. Mm. They're supposed to be going out, doing the hunting, bringing the dead animal back, and, you know, making sure that no wolves attack the family and things like that. One thing that we often overlook is that the husband is not just supposed to do that in a material sense. He's also supposed to be an emotional support as well. And that's, I feel like that is the main problem and the main issue when it comes to all of this. They realize maybe their duties when it comes to those, you know, the caveman, the typical caveman stuff. Yeah. But when it comes to being an emotional support, a spiritual support, that's missing. And I feel like that is where you get these kind of
dysfunctional
families.
Now, first of all, all these works
families.
You have mentioned, first of all, it's the verse is like, you know, I guess it also says that, you know, it is for a man to realize that these are his duties. You know, he needs to look after the family.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any man who doesn't realize that? Actually, you
in
know what? That was
world,
a stupid question. No, a lot of men don't realize that.
Yeah, so it's for the men to realize that they have to look after the family. They need to protect their family. You know, they are the breadwinner of the family. So, first of all, the man should realize what are his duties and his responsibilities.
I just want to have a disclaimer. I want to throw a disclaimer out there. We're talking about this from an Islamic viewpoint, because if you want to discuss that with the 21st century modern millennial or whatever person, they'd be like, oh, why does a man get to be the breadwinner? I'm a woman, I can go win bread.
Yeah, guys, we're right? not going into that.
Yeah, I don't believe in that ganache. I would very much like to stay home and let him go win whatever he wants to win and, like, bring me the hunt, man. I'll break my nails if I go out and get sunburned. No.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The man should protect the family. It doesn't mean that the woman cannot protect the family.
True.
So we need to keep this in mind. Like, you know, man should, you know, win the bread. Like, it doesn't mean that woman cannot earn.
Mm.
Like, she can do the work, like, you know, in the Islamic way, which, you know, the Islam allows her.
Mm.
So it's not about, like, degrading the women.
Exactly. It's just putting more responsibility on men.
Unity of leadership is vital, you know, for any boat.
Mm.
And for the boat of home, for it to be stable, there should be one leader.
One captain, yeah.
One captain, one leader.
Yeah.
So it can be any. So now we look, there's a father and there's a mother.
Right.
So now we look at the characteristics, the qualities, the traits of a mother and a father. We understand that, you know, the mother is like more emotional type. And there's certain characteristics of a father and a mother. Father, the qualities of the father, you know, fits more to take the leadership of the family.
So you're saying that there are innate qualities in men that just enables them.
Yeah.
That entails that position of authority to an extent. We're talking about situations where they fail. I mean, that's great. In an ideal utopic world, the man has all the qualities of a good man, and he does.
You fail in the sense that they are not fulfilling
their duties,
or
they're
just
not fulfilling their duties. They want the authority.
Or just the mother has overtaken.
They want the men. They want that position of authority still, but they haven't done anything to earn it. At that point, as a woman, I'm like, just sit down. Dude, just sit down. Stop talking and sit down. You know?
Yeah.
I'm talking about those situations. And in those situations, it's often he tries to insert his authority by force because he's failed to earn it through other means of being a man.
Yeah, the home is like politics, okay? This is one way to understand it. Some men go too right wing. Some men go too left wing, right? So the right wing is probably what you're talking about, right, where they just like, you know, I'm a beast man, this is my house, and, you know, I control things, and, you know, smash it.
Wreck it, Ralph.
Yeah, yeah. So then that's, you know, and there's absolutely no emotion there. There's no understanding.
Mm. And it brings about more damage than anything else.
Right.
It defeats the objective of having a protector who you need protection from.
Yeah.
Your garments for them and their garments for you.
Right? Okay, now, if we look at what this means, what do clothes actually do? First of all, they cover you, right? But they protect you. They protect you from harsh weather, whether it's cold or whether it's hot.
Yeah.
Another thing that clothes do is they give you a sense of position. And
exactly.
It highlights what you are.
Yeah.
So you'll see that a doctor wears certain clothes. A worker in the street wear certain clothes, you know, a nurse, whoever, right? They all wear a sheikh, right? They wear certain clothes which distinguish. We're supposed to do that for each other. As a husband and wife,
you're
supposed to kind of appreciate one another.
And compliment one another.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for. They're supposed to compliment one another. When a man becomes too right-wing, there's none of that. It's just... There's none of that emotional understanding. Okay. That's right wing.
Right.
He's just a beast man now. Left wing is also an issue. And I feel like that is a bigger issue in the West, where men are just, they're just not men anymore.
They're so marginalized.
They're just
you know,
pansies.
In the name, they really are pansies.
Pansies, you know. Just,
in the name
your wife is saying, oh, you know, I want to go to a party in the middle of the night. It's a mixed gathering. Oh, and I'm not going to wear hijab. And you, well, it's your choice, sweetheart. You know,
what about protecting her? What happens to protecting
her? There's no protection. And, you know, in Islam, we have a concept of they're not men anymore. You've got to have a concept of ghira. Islam promotes this idea that you're supposed to have a sense of possessiveness. This
protectiveness.
Is, you know, protectiveness. This chivalry.
Being
a gentleman.
Yes, chivalry.
You know, being a man is not about,
but,
you know...
So, in the limits of Islam, right? Not just, like, enforcing any laws upon her. Like,
exactly.
But in the limits of Islam.
Definitely. Not just bullying her around, telling her that, okay, treating her like a piece of property, like something he owns.
Yeah.
And, like, either my way or the highway, I'm going to beat you because I'm loud, because I'm a man. You know what I'm saying? I don't know why did the accent come in, but it always comes in when I'm talking about toxic masculinity. I'm a man.
I'm a Mayan.
Why do you guys think that some men, as Brother Muzaffar said, have those right-wing inclinations? Why are they so rough and tough without a touch of humanity and compassion and subtleness? The same Amir al-Mu'mineen who told you to keep your wife at home and if you can, like, not let her come in contact with any man, do that, it's better for her. The same Amir al-Mu'mineen says, al-mar'atu rayhana, she's a flower. What are you doing beating a flower around? In which universe does that work? So my question is that what causes this sort of mentality in our men?
First of all, when they assume, you know, they are the bosses of the family, like, you know, in the wrong sense, that being boss, that they can do anything. They're the leader and everyone's, you know, they're inferior to them and they can do anything. And the duties that they have to do, they're not fulfilling them in the right ways.
Why have they missed out on the real core concept of being the boss, being the authority position? They just get the authority position. They don't get the responsibility that being an
authority
entails.
They have
not understood
the whole idea of being the leader of the family, right? You know, being the, take out the wrong meaning in the wrong way, the wrong sense, that they're the leader of the family. But they actually don't know the meaning of the leader, how you lead something. They just thought that we're the leader, we can do anything.
So what's the leader supposed to do in your understanding?
Like we said, that they have to lead a family.
You know, what does leading a family mean? Like leading them on a hike?
Okay, looking after the, you know, as I said earlier, that there should be one captain. You know, the final decision should be, you know, from one captain. Like, it's a family, like children and the mother. They decide something. You know, children decide something, the mother decides something. And
the dad gets the final call.
Ahsan. That's the thing. Like, being a leader, like, you know, listening to them, looking at the good side and the bad side, looking at the consequences, what consequences it can have. So, by that, the father gives the final call. Mm. So, you know, here there's an instability. Like, you know, children wants to go somewhere. If, you know, family wants to go out, children wants to go somewhere, the mother and the father. So, there should be one final call. The captain should say one final statement.
Right.
So, here, the father decides, you know, over here, leadership is not like, you know, I want to go.
Everyone listen to me.
You know, to the hill station.
Mm.
So, you know, you're forced that we are going to the hill station. It's not like that. You know,
that kind of man is actually mal'oon in our ahadith. Mal'oonun mal'oon, a person who forces his family to do things that he likes to do, to eat the food he likes to eat and stuff like that, which is, you know, a big deal. Rasulullah doesn't often say mal'oonun mal'oon. Cursed is he, curses he, because he's a prophet of mercy. But regarding men who dictate their own liking and their own opinions onto their family, Rasulullah said they're cursed. We're out of time. I just want to ask Brother Muzaffar this question. What makes them like that? What makes them abusive? What makes them want to be the authority without understanding their responsibility and authority, being authority entails?
Yeah, I think everybody has an inclination towards being asfal asafirin, becoming the lowest of the low, whether we're men or women, right? Men have certain chemicals in their bodies. They have a certain different type. They have more testosterone and less estrogen and the other, you know, emotional chemicals. So when they tend towards their animalistic side more, they become very ugly, beastly vicious things. And I'm only speaking from experience, because I tend to become a little bit right wing sometimes, right? It's something that we all need to work on. After this discussion, though, I'm convinced that maybe it would be a better approach for men. Or husbands out there, fathers out there, whenever you're angry, don't say any verses of the Quran, don't say any hadith. Keep it real, just to discuss between each other and, you know, settle your differences. Let those hadith and those verses reach your wife from a different source, but you're not the right person to give those things at that moment.
Exactly.
I think that would be a good approach to take. And
finally, I would like to just say that I feel society has failed men. The same society that failed to a very great extent to protect women, it failed to teach men how to be the protectors, and it failed to teach them what a noble status it is to be the protector of Allah's beautiful little flowers. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا التي أما رايزك لا تعصي دليلك وانسك.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.